Good morning to you, Lake Merced Church.
Good morning.
I'm going to begin this morning. I want to throw a question out to you, and this is not a rhetorical question. I'm kind of curious to see what you'll say. Think about the word commitment. Now, what comes to mind when you think about the word commitment? Anybody?
Marriage.
Okay, that's a good one. In a good marriage, there will
promise.
Be commitment. Okay, promise.
Dedication.
Happy. Okay, do any images come to mind when you think about the word commitment? Pictures.
Jesus in the garden.
Garden of Gethsemane, sweating blood because he doesn't want to go forward to this bitter end that he's facing that actually wasn't the end in reality.
Jesus on the cross,
okay. Jesus is like the picture of commitment, right? That's where our minds go. And that's good. That's really good. You know, I think I agree with all of those. Well, I want to think about this idea of commitment this morning just a little bit for a little devotional thought. And what I'd like to do in order to kind of hone our minds in on this is we're going to look at a story about three men's commitment to their king. This is a story that you may have read before. How many of you guys are familiar with the story of King David? Raise your hand. Okay, most of you. We're going to look at a little snippet from his life that you probably have read before, but you may have just read over this, and you may not even remember that this is in the Bible. But just to bring us up to this point in the story, King David, for those of you that don't know, he was the second king of Israel. This is way back, several thousand years ago. The first king of Israel was King Saul. And while Saul was king, there was this big Philistine named Goliath, who was actually 9 feet tall, who came out and started challenging the Israelite army, saying, if you send somebody over that can beat me, then we'll surrender, and you can basically rule the Philistines, and we'll leave you alone and all this stuff. But if I beat you, then it's going to be that way for us. We're going to rule you. You surrender to us. We win. Nobody would face this big Philistine, this big giant. Except for this boy, David, the shepherd. You guys who know the story are familiar with this. He comes in from the fields. He sees this big Philistine talking trash. Nobody's going to fight him. And so what does he do? He goes and he kills him with what? Kills him with a sling, right? A little kid's toy. He goes and kills this big warrior giant, chops off his head, takes his sword. I mean, great guy story, right? So really neat. And his fame increases after this. He takes down this giant, and suddenly he's famous. Saul brings him into his court. He likes the kid at first. He puts him in charge of a group of men. The men go out, they start carrying out raids against the Philistines, and the maidens in the country start singing songs. Does anybody remember what the song was? They sang a song, Saul has killed thousands, but David has tens of thousands. Okay, so like Saul is sort of famous, King Saul, the guy who's in charge of all Israel, but here's David, this boy who came in from the country, and suddenly the maidens are singing about how his fame and his greatness is actually greater than King Saul. Now, what do you think King Saul thought about this? He wasn't too happy about this, right? And so he starts sending David as a commander of these armies into battles that he thinks that David will lose. He sends him into these battles hoping that the Philistines will kill David because he doesn't like these maidens singing these songs about how David is actually greater than him. And that doesn't work. David continues to win these battles. He continues to be victorious. He continues to just rout these Philistines every time he goes up against them. And then Saul gets tired of this because his fame is just getting greater and he's actually doing the opposite of what he wants it to do. And so he takes a more direct approach and he decides that he's going to get some men and he's actually going to go kill him. Well, word gets out. David hears about this. David flees. And it's at this point in the story that we're going to pick up. David is running from King Saul. He set up shop in this cave and all of these ragtag outcasts come to him and are drawn to him. So go ahead and hit that first slide. In 1 Samuel 22, verse 1, it says, David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Okay, Saul is after him. When his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their leader. About 400 men were with him. So David surrounds himself with this band of outcasts.
He's in this cave. By the way, this cave, Adullam, this is just a few miles away from Bethlehem. You guys know what Bethlehem is famous for? The birthplace of Jesus. Do you know what it was famous for before Jesus was born? It was famous as the birthplace of David. Okay, so this is David's hometown of Bethlehem, familiar territory with him. Also, there is a band of Philistines who have been raiding, carrying out raids in this part of the country. One of the reasons David picked this cave to hide in is because he could hide from Saul, but at the same time, he could continue with his 400 people go out and fight the Philistines. The Philistines had actually taken over the town of Bethlehem at this point in the story. Okay, so David is walking along one day, and he's in the hills. He's overlooking Bethlehem. How many of you guys have ever gone back to the house that you grew up in? Have any of you ever done this? Have you ever gone back to that? Okay. What happens when you go back and you see the house that you grew up in? It looks smaller. Okay. That's not what I was going for, but that may be true. You start having these memories come back to you, right? You start remembering all these experiences that you had. You start recounting all these stories because your formative years were spent in this place. And well, the same thing happens to David in this story. He's in the hills. He's overlooking his hometown where he grew up, where he watered his father's sheep. He had all these experiences, and he begins getting a little reminiscent. He begins getting a little nostalgic. And he says, man, oh, I remember the well that's down there. And it's so hot today, you know, sweat's dripping down my face. I've got all this military garb on. He says out loud, oh, that I could have a drink of that water. Because he could remember that well where he used to water his father's sheep. He could remember the cool, crisp, clear water, how refreshing it was. And he was so hot and it was sticky. And so he says this out loud, not really meaning anything by it, other than he's just thinking out loud. We all do this, right? Sometimes we think out loud when we think nobody's around and somebody hears something dumb that we've said and they think we're crazy, but that's okay. David is thinking out loud and these guys hear him talking, and he must have said this where at least three of his buddies could overhear, because these guys, Ish-bosheth, Eleazar, and Shema, we know all heard this. Now, you need to know something about, how many of you seen 300? You seen the movie 300? Nobody in here. Okay. Two females and three guys. Okay. That's about right. 300 is a big guy movie. It's about the Spartans who go and they do all these battles and kill all these people, and it's just great. I went with a bunch of guys and there was a standing ovation at the end of the movie. It was just really kind of a neat thing. These guys, if you can picture the warriors in 300, that's like these guys, Ish-bosheth, Eleazar, and Shema. These guys are bad dudes. These are guys who were among those known as the mighty men of David. And Ish-bosheth had killed 800 men with his spear. Okay, that's a lot of men. Shema had at one time single-handedly protected a field of crops from a whole army of Philistines who were trying to come and take it. Eleazar had at one point stood alongside David, taunting a Philistine army until they charged. Everybody ran away except for Eleazar, and he fought this Philistine army and killed hundreds of these men. The Bible says until the sword was frozen to his hand. Okay, he cramped up or something. He killed hundreds of these guys. And so these are bad guys. These are the guys that hear David reminiscing. And so look at what happens next. And we're flipping over to 2 Samuel. This is them recounting the past. 2 Samuel 23, verse 15. David longed for water and said, oh, that someone would get me a drink of water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem. Now, by the way, that's not a command. This is just him thinking out loud. When my mom, when I was a kid, wanted me to go clean my room, she didn't say, oh, that Wesley would go clean his room. She said, boy, go clean your room. Okay, that's not what he's saying here. He's not saying, guys, go get me some water. He's just thinking out loud, oh, that someone would get me some water. But then look what happens in verse 16. It says, so the three mighty men broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. But he refused to drink it. Instead, he poured it out to the Lord. Now that's easy just to read over, isn't it? I mean, that's just a couple of verses there. You're just like, yeah, let's go read the neat stories here. This is wild. Can you see this unfolding? David is thinking about how he would just sort of like a drink from the well. He doesn't tell the guys, go get me a drink of water. He's thinking, man, it would be nice to have a drink of water. These three warriors go down into Bethlehem, a city that has been taken over by a foreign army who hated Israelites. They fight through the battle lines. I don't know how they pulled this off. I don't know if two of them were fending off the Philistines while one was drawing the water. But somehow they get water out of this well. They somehow manage to get it back to David without spilling it in the midst of this battle. And they give it to their king simply because he's thinking out loud saying, man, it'd be nice to have a drink. That is a picture of commitment right there. And this is just wild. And can you imagine what David thought when these guys bring this water to him? You know, what is he thinking? Like, are you guys crazy? I didn't mean for you to do this. And then what are they thinking? Go to the next slide. When he does what he does, but he refused to drink it, in 16b, he poured it out before the Lord and said, far be it from me, O Lord, to do this. He said, is it not the blood of men who went at the risk of their lives? And David would not drink it. Such were the exploits of the three mighty men. So what are they thinking when they go through all this rigmarole to get this water and bring it back to David, and then instead of drinking it, he pours it out in front of them? You know, would they have been upset? They would not have been upset, because it says that David poured it out before the Lord. He poured that water out as a sacrifice to the Lord, and this would have really honored these men. He makes a sacrifice to the Lord. By the way, sacrifice, if something is really a sacrifice, the nature of sacrifice is to give up something you'd rather keep. Okay, so David makes a sacrifice to the Lord, honors these men in doing so, and that's the story. So what can we learn from this morning? I've just got two things that I want to point out. First, commitment to something great always begins with a risk. These men took a great risk in going down to get their king a drink of water. When we commit to do something great, it's always going to involve a risk. And if you think about it, every noteworthy contribution, every great thing that has been done in the history of mankind, every truly great thing has involved risk. Abraham took a big risk when he left to follow God's command to go to another country, a foreign land that he didn't know about. The prophets all took a risk. Great risks to their personal lives when they went to speak to people that often, 9 times out of 10, did not want to hear what they had to say and often killed them or mistreated them. Martin Luther took a great risk in speaking out against the Catholic Church long ago, what led to the Reformation. Abe Lincoln took a great risk in abolishing slavery. Martin Luther King took a great risk in leading the civil rights movement. All great things that people can do involve risk. Commitment to that involves risk. Secondly, your actions will always show what your commitments really, where your commitments really lie. Your actions will show where your commitments really lie. Have you ever read this love note? It says, my love is so great for you, honey. I would cross the deepest ocean. I'd climb the highest mountain. I would leap tall buildings, whatever. But if it's raining, I'm not going to be able to make it tonight. Have you ever heard that love letter? That guy's not really committed, because it's not the thought that counts. A lot of people say it's the thought that counts. No, it's not. It's the action that counts. And so if you say you're committed to something, if you say you're committed to Jesus Christ, but then you live in another way, that's not commitment. You can say it all day long. These guys could have said, man, I thought about going to get you some water. It's not the same thing, is it? Pretty simple. So just to close out, how would the world look if all the people who claim to be disciples of Jesus were willing to take a risk as serious as these guys who went and got this water for their king? What would the world look like if our commitment to our king was as great as these guys' commitment was to their king?